United States versus Rhodes. Mr. McGowan.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Counsel. My name is Andrew McGowan. I'm with the Federal Public Defender's Office for the Central District of Illinois, and I represent the appellant in this case, Mr. Rhodes. Mr. Rhodes is appealing almost every aspect of the restitution order in this case, and for that reason, I believe it's appropriate to make a brief overview of what that restitution statutes, what the restitution statutes in this case require. And in general, the district court is to first determine who are the victims. After that, the district court is to determine what the restitution is based on what those victims are harmed by. And in fact, the restitution order statutes in this case particularly state that the district court is not to determine, base the determination in any way on whether the victims have been compensated already. I believe that the district court did it backwards in this case, which leads to the appeal here. The district court determined that the victims had been compensated. They'd been compensated by Magna Investments, and therefore Magna Investments was a victim, and therefore the amount of restitution in this case was the amount that Magna paid to the victims. The victims in this case are the people who were harmed specifically by the fraud, and those are the investors. Now, at the time, Mr. Rhodes worked for Magna Investments. And there's no question that the 240 people that we refer to in the brief and the government refers to are victims. We're not saying they're not, but what we're saying is that Magna is not a victim. Magna is a tortfeasor. If any kind of characterization could be made of Magna's participation, Magna made some money on the commissions, about 70 grand. Furthermore, as I said before, the statute particularly talks about not determining restitution based on money that has been paid to the victims. And in this case, Magna did pay the money to victims, but we don't know what that money, we don't know the breakdown of what Magna paid and why. There are two sections that talk about other people compensating victims. One of the sections has to do with the fact that restitution shouldn't be determined based on how much the victims have been compensated. And the other one is that the people who have compensated victims are a part of the ultimate order for restitution because they should be compensated for how much they've paid the victims. And we're not saying that Magna shouldn't be compensated if there is restitution in this case. We're just saying that we don't know how much that restitution should be. And that's because we don't believe that Magna is a victim. Because Magna is not a victim, the measure of restitution in this case should be based on the harm to the investors that Mr. Rhodes hurt. The measure should be, in this case, a restitution should be based on the amount of money, the difference between what the investors asked for and what they were given. Now, what the investors asked for, in the most part, were short-term CDs. I'm overgeneralizing here, but that's in the record. What they were given instead were long-term CDs. And there is no evaluation of the difference at the time either the fraud was discovered or at sentencing, the difference between what those values should be. And that's what we're complaining about in terms of the amount of restitution in this case. Because the district court did not evaluate each individual victim's harm, we don't know specifically what those amounts that Magna made were based on. We know for some, they were based on the difference between the value that Magna determined the products that the investors had at the time the fraud was discovered, the difference between that value and the value that they were able to sell them for. However, in this case, there would be penalties for the long-term CDs being sold. We don't know if Magna, which was a subsidiary of a company that owned both Magna Investments and Magna Bank, included waived fees or other matters. There's no indication of how the $1 million was broken down in this case. Finally, Your Honors, we have appealed the district court's order that the restitution payment be made immediately. We don't believe that that's been waived. However, we do admit that it's been forfeited, and this will be under the plain error standard of review. We submit that to the extent that the cases Mohammed and Jarosenko disagree or are in conflict with the holding in McIntosh, that this court should hold that Jarosenko and Mohammed are more binding.
We should revisit McIntosh.
Thank you. And for the very reasons that the statute requires that these evaluations of the defendant's ability to pay, that sort of thing, be taken into account in determining the restitution amount.
Is that true under the new act?
Yes, Your Honor, it's specifically true under the new act. I cite section 3664F2. It says, upon determination of the amount of restitution owed to each victim, the court shall, pursuant to section 3572, which is the section that has to do with fines, specify in the restitution order the manner in which and the schedule according to which the restitution is to be paid in consideration of, one, the financial resources and other assets of the defendant, including whether any of these assets are jointly controlled, b, projected earnings and other income of the defendants, and three, and c, I should say, any financial obligations of the defendant, including obligations to the defendant. And I would submit that sentencing is the appropriate time to make these determinations. Most sentencings have defendants who are going to be serving some time. In this case, the defendant was sentenced to.
Were these earlier cases of ours under the MVRA?
Your Honor, I believe that neither of them are. Jarosenko was decided in 96, and I believe, although it's not specified, that it would be under the Victims and Witnesses Protection Act. McIntosh is, but it doesn't make a distinction between the two that I could tell. And I would submit that there is a conflict in the circuit on these two cases, and that McIntosh would be wrongly decided under the law as it exists. Thank you, Your Honor. I will reserve the rest of my time if there are no questions.
Very good.
Rebuttal. Thank you.
Mr. Hartzler? That short. Just keeps going.
Yeah,
you have to. You have to
begin to move with sudden stuff.
Yeah, it's
impressive though. Thank you. Good morning, Your Honor.
Good morning.
May it please the court. My name is Joe Hartzler. I'm representing the United States in this matter. I actually think this is a fairly simple case, and there is not too terribly much disagreement between the parties. The issue that's raised is really resolved by the statute. That's Title 18. Section 3664, and in particular with reference to the subsection J1, which provides in essence that when victims suffer a loss that is compensated by an insurance company or some third party, the restitution order should be directed at the party that compensates the victim. There's really no dispute that the investors gave money to Rhodes. Rhodes inappropriately invested it for them, and as a result, they were the victims. We're not claiming that Magna was in any way a direct victim of the fraud that Rose committed. But once the fraud was discovered, Magna stepped in and, to its credit, immediately compensated the victims, and so ultimately it is the entity that suffered the loss. There's some issue raised as to the timing of the liquidation of the underlying assets, that is the fraudulent fraudulently acquired long-term CDs. And I think that if you refer again to Section 3664J1, the strong implication is that restitution should be ordered to the party who has compensated the victims. There's a suggestion that you don't wait until the day of sentencing to liquidate those assets. It is sort of ironic that in this case, had they waited until the day of sentencing, held on to those long-term CDs, while interest rates both went north and then dramatically south, yes, they may not have suffered the same loss. But let's face it, that's not the way people transact business in the real world. They liquidated the assets as soon as the fraud was discovered, or really as soon as the various victims stated that these were not the investments that they had wanted. For policy purposes, I think this is the way we want things to occur. We would like a deep pocket to step in and compensate the victims as soon as possible, and therefore take the place of the victims at sentencing and become the beneficiary of a restitution order. So I think that what the district court did in this case was perfectly proper. You'll notice that we both cited Marlatt as well as, how could I be forgetful, Shepard. Both those cases involve very different circumstances, but in each case, had J1 been applied as it was in this case, the result that this court reached would have been the result reached in the district court, that the third party that compensated the victims for the amount of the loss would have been the beneficiary of the restitution order. If there are no questions from the court.
With respect to the last point, Mr. Hartsley, you and your colleague are in disagreement as to whether the district judge had the obligation to take into consideration the defendant's economic circumstances in deciding whether the amount should be due and payable immediately or whether or not a schedule should be put in place. Your colleague says the cases upon which you've relied in your brief do not comport with the new statute. I'd like your reaction to that.
With all due respect, I thought that my colleague said the same thing that I would have to say, that I'm not confident that those decisions from this court didn't apply the statute. I thought that they did. He seems to think that they do not. If we're talking about the Mandatory Victim Restitution Act, mm-hmm. I thought they did apply that law. I can say that fairly consistently we are requesting and obtaining restitution orders that are due and payable immediately. Of course, it's a matter of enforcement convenience when the restitution order is not ordered pursuant to any schedule. Let's face it, this was $1 million for a man that has appointed counsel and is now in jail. So there was not a realistic opportunity that we're going to collect $1 million. On the other hand, to the extent that there are assets available, and I believe this record indicates that he lived in a luxury home and drove luxury automobile, things of that sort, by having the restitution order due and payable immediately for the benefit of the victims or the third party that compensated the victims, it thereby becomes enforceable against those various assets immediately.
I don't think there's any question about the fact the district court could, in fact, do that for you.
Right.
Simply that he has to take into consideration the economic circumstances of the defendant in doing so. The statute simply requires that he take that into consideration. There's no indication he did here.
Well, he obviously took the financial circumstances under consideration in waiving a fine. So I think that the judge took into consideration the defendant's financial circumstances in this case and in most of these cases. But I think that the cases that this court has previously decided indicate that it's appropriate, even in circumstances where the fine is waived, to order the restitution due and payable immediately. It's not a question of whether you take into account the financial circumstances. Everybody recognizes that this is a defendant who is indigent. And there would be some artificiality about establishing a restitution schedule in that circumstance as opposed to making it due and payable immediately and thereby enforceable immediately. I hope I'm answering your question.
No, it's just a matter of what the statute says as to what the district court has to take into consideration. The
yes.
Older cases do seem to imply that in determining whether or not to make it due and payable immediately or to impose a payment schedule, the court need not take into consideration the financial circumstances of the defendant. That, under the new statute, it seems that he has to do that.
And I hope I'm suggesting that typically that is done. You're questioning whether or not that's articulated well enough on the record. I can't recall the specifics of the record, but typically the pre-sentence report will disclose all of the defendant's financial circumstances that have to be taken into consideration in determining whether there's a fine or not.
Right.
And I think you can fairly assume or infer from that fact that it's taken into consideration in reaching restitution. Now, whether that was well articulated, I can't answer that question right now.
Thank you.
Well, the report, though, Mr. Arthur, would have contained, for example, possession of the home or the car. And
right. Right.
So that's what you're speaking of when you say it may well have been before the district court.
Right. And I don't mean to mislead you. I think that the house was substantially encumbered. I don't believe that he had any...
Whatever.
Right.
He had, the PSR...
It's all disclosed.
Probably had it.
That's right. It's all disclosed at the time.
Doesn't our court hold it when they say immediate payment that it means to the best of your ability?
Oh, right. Yeah, no, I didn't mean to suggest that we're going to get a summary judgment against it. I mean, in effect, that's what the restitution order is.
Right.
But it's not really enforceable if they don't have $1 million.
Yeah,
no, absolutely.
You don't think a contempt order a month later.
Right, yeah, yeah, yeah. Or that we would, you know, once he gets out of prison, that we would try to revoke his supervised release because he hasn't paid $1 million. That's not...
If he isn't paying, and they do, if the probation officer knows that he is able to pay, then he brings him back in for a probation violation.
All based on good faith.
And then the court can set a specific schedule
if it
sees fit. Isn't that true?
That's the process.
Well,
thank you.
I wouldn't want to argue with my colleague here, but or adjust what is existing a schedule in place. When you suggest it be paid immediately, that is a schedule, right?
That is a schedule?
It is a schedule. You say due and payable immediately, that's a schedule.
Well, it's a schedule based on this court's decision,
right,
that the defendant exercised best effort. So
right,
it's not a schedule in terms of $5 a week, obviously. I mean, it's not a specific schedule, but it's a best effort implication based on the rulings of this
court. Well, it in effect says everything's due and owing today, but you get what you can today. There's a practical aspect to it. In other words, you don't build into it an immediate failure rate by putting a schedule in place that has no likelihood of being met, let's say, during periods of incarceration.
Yes. The implication is this court has thought through these issues and resolved them previously. I'm in complete agreement.
All right. I think we'll hear a dissenting view from Mr. McGowan, but I don't want to jump in ahead of him.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hartford. Mr. McGowan.
McGowan, I would appreciate your reply to what counsel for the government has just said on this last point.
Thank you, Your Honor. I was certainly intending to do that anyway, but the practical effect of the court's ordering that the restitution be made paid due immediately is that sometime down the line, probation does determine how much money they think that the person can come up with. And
the judge doesn't have to accept that, does he, Mr. McGowan?
No, I mean, there can be all kinds of proceedings after the person is released from prison based on their ability to pay, based on their having a job. But stop the fact that the statute says that a payment schedule should be ordered at sentencing, and I think that's the most appropriate time.
How can you order it at sentencing if you don't know what the man is going to earn when he gets out or whether or not he's going to be employed? They're not mind readers.
I know that, but they do know exactly what he's got at the time of sentencing. And
pardon me?
The judge is aware of what he's got at the time of sentencing. In fact, the pre-sentence report, although I don't have a copy to show you, includes a lot of information about his assets, his marriage, where his wife worked.
But isn't our case law very clear that immediately means that you begin paying immediately to the best of your ability?
Yes, but...
And that's
the
what
question
our
is,
court has written, isn't that true?
Yes, but the question is,
what does that mean to you?
To me, that means that when the person's released, the probation office tells them, you've got to come up with 50 or 200 bucks a month, and if they don't, the probation office writes a letter to the judge saying he's in violation. That's what practically happens, and that's why it's more important for the person who's being sentenced to know exactly how much he's got to pay when he gets released.
Well, is it your contention, or isn't it, that at the time of sentencing, this particular trial judge did not take into consideration the man's capacity to pay?
It is my consideration based on the opinion that we've cited in in the back of the brief that he did not take that into consideration, didn't believe he had to because he was not making a scheduled payment.
And you think that was an error of law?
Yes, Your Honor, I do.
What particular statute does that violate?
That violates the statute that I quoted at length that requires, when the judge orders restitution, that's 3664F2.
So you're not disagreeing with anyone that the district court had the right to make this all due and paying payment and paid immediately. You're just saying that before he entered that order, he had to at least take into consideration the man's capacity to pay. Is that correct?
I go a little farther than that, Your Honor. I believe that the judge has to take this into account and they have to set a schedule.
And he has to set a schedule?
A payment schedule for when he's released.
How does he know that the man's wife or he isn't going to be seriously ill at the time?
Of his release?
Yes. How does the judge know that?
He doesn't.
Is somebody getting out?
That's something that can also happen in good faith after the sentencing.
See, if I understand this, kind of the thrust of your argument is that, however impractical it may appear to some of us, there has to be not only a finding of available resources, but the statute commands, a strict reading of the statute, commands that some sort of chapter and verse be set out, and that our case law, which is permitted to say that it's due immediately, doesn't constitute a schedule.
I believe that that when the judge makes a payment due immediately, that would be considered a schedule.
Right.
But I don't think it would be appropriate in cases where the person's indigent and after evaluation of the person's finances.
So that's in effect not setting a schedule, you're saying. Where we got somebody going who, let's say, who is indigent and is going to prison immediately, that say it's due and owing that day is to not set a schedule.
Your Honor, I think it's probably a schedule, but it's not a schedule of payments. It's an order, and perhaps it's not a schedule of payments per se, because it's due and owing immediately.
The law, hopefully, isn't always an if. You reach a point where you've got to have some logic to what the heck's going on. And if you project out, the only person who projects it out, who does that projecting out for the court? Probably the probation officer, right?
As a practical matter, yes.
So, is your charge that there's some sort of inappropriate delegation? Our case will allow some inappropriate delegation to a probation officer when we say or have allowed that say it's due and owing on day one?
Yes, Your Honor, that's fair.
I mean, isn't that what the challenge is to the McIntosh case?
That is the challenge. That is the challenge that we're raising. Yes,
all right. Don't be afraid to attack it. Some of us are wrong sometimes.
And I would,
you've got standing with this court.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would add that I think if the court thinks through it, sentencing is the most appropriate time for this schedule to be arranged. Now, it can be rearranged later. Thank you, Your Honor.
I understand. Thank you, Mr. McGowan. Mr. Hartford, it's good to see you in court again. You should come up more often. I know you love the confines of Springfield as opposed to Chicago these days. But
thank you, Judge.
Both of you have a safe trip home.